All right, boys, just listen up for a sec. Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
How does that sound make you feel? Give me some adjectives.
It's nice. It's kind of like reassuring. Steady.
That sounds like a very accurate kind of... I really like the sound of that mechanism.
It's very precise, isn't it?
Yeah. It also makes me feel like I should be somewhere that I'm not. Like I'm in a rush or something.
What have
I
forgotten?
Kind of running late. But it does sound very nice.
I think all of that is very valid, boys. But let me tell you, this is the sound of a British-designed mechanical timepiece from the talented team at Marlowe Watch Company, sponsors of this episode. And with Marlowe, each collection is influenced by a historical story of inspiring human endeavour. Now, I've spent some time at their HQ recently because, well, I'm curious about mechanical timekeeping and also how things work. And I can tell you that there is so much very pleasing attention to detail that goes into each and every watch design. Now, these guys are serious about their watches, and you can tell by looking at some of the watch reviews online. I mean, the words quality and value come up time and again. Visit marlowewatchcompany.com to see for yourself. Marlowe Watch Company, time well spent, which I also like to think could be said for this podcast.
Things that get very confusing in my world are calendar dates, because we deal with America and Asia quite regularly. So when it's 5th of the 3rd, is that in a few days' time or is that May?
The meeting on Wednesday has been moved forward by 2 days. When is the meeting?
This week, we've picked Jono's helpful sketch that explores the meaning of the word bi-weekly. For that first week, we had a lot of vegetables to eat.
Did it mean it meant twice a week?
It meant twice
yeah,
a week.
Really, yeah.
It was a good week for soup.
Yeah.
The typical Western way is that time is like this long timeline that's spread out in front of us. There are some cultures where they say, well, you can see the past, but you can't see the future. So for them, the future's stretching out behind them, but the past is in front of them.
Hello, and welcome to Sketchplanations, the podcast. When the 1029 train gets cancelled due to last-minute industrial action and you've time to kill before you know there's a fast and furious scrap to be had to secure a seat on the now guaranteed to be rammed next service to King's Cross Station in London in just over an hour's time, there are three options. Option one, sulk, bemoan the blooming railways in Britain and let this unfortunate situation ruin the rest of your day. Option two, go for a lovely walk around the historic city of York in the north of England and soak up some cultural and architectural wonderment spanning the ages. The Shambles, for example, is often referred to as the best preserved medieval street in Europe. Or option three, find a cafe nearby, buy a coffee, and settle in to start prepping the next episode of the podcast. And so here we are, listeners, all of us here now, a community brought together through adversity. Stronger than ever, defiant in our resolve to make lemonade. I'm Rob Bell, seasoned lemon picker, and joining me once again on our curious exploration of the world, always positive, always cheerful, our very own man from Del Monte, he who says yes to the best, it's John O'Hay. And perched up high in the trees on his continuous campaign of chaos, occasionally chucking fruit at passers-by. He's charismatic, he's cheeky, he's a little monkey, all right. It's Tom Pellerow. Hello, my friends. Are you well?
Good evening.
Hello. Just get a hat like the man from Del Monte.
Oh, they were good ads, weren't they? I watched some of those back on YouTube, writing that, just for fun. Just to see, because I got confused between the man who likes to say yes or and the bank that likes to say yes, because that was like Midland Bank, wasn't it?
I don't know. Was it the man from Del Monte likes to say yes or something?
Yeah. Yeah. And he'd go around.
Taste the juice.
Yeah, he'd go off flying around in his cool little planes and helicopters and land in the most remote parts of the world where they're growing the fruit. And I don't know if he ever actually said yes or if it was just a knowing nod.
It was very much a non-speaking role for the actor, wasn't it, probably?
Yeah.
Worked in all languages.
Which typically you don't get paid as much for, but, yeah. You know, they had to get him back each time. He was the man from Del Monte. How are you at dealing with delays to your journeys, boys? That is genuinely what happened to me recently.
If I'm in the right place, I don't mind a delay. It feels a bit like... It depends. It all depends, doesn't it? It all depends. Yeah. If you really want to get back, it's a pain. But if you're a bit relaxed about when you get somewhere, I don't mind it. It feels a bit like bonus time, but...
Yeah, a bit of free time. It depends on the length of the trip that you've got coming up, maybe, like the length of journey. As you say, what's on the other end? Are you on your own, or have you got family or dependents around you as well?
Not long ago, I was in Minneapolis, and my flight got completely cancelled, and there was nowhere to get around. And so I stayed the night and went to the largest mall in America by myself.
Brilliant. That's not bad, is it?
It was all right. It's all right, yeah.
That's not a bad experience that you wouldn't have had. Now you can say that. I've been to the largest mall in America?
I think it's called the Mall of America.
Oh, the Mall of America. Yeah, great. Yeah. Would you say that's the best delay you've ever had?
I hope not.
It's hard to think, isn't it? It's hard to think about delay. The best. Yeah, a good delay.
It was pretty good because I couldn't go the normal route, and so I had to go via Texas and dropped in on a good friend. Yes. So that was amazing. Yeah, that probably was the best delay I've ever had. Yeah, although once they offered us the money to fly the next day, you know that one when they've overbooked a flight?
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm never in a position to take it, but once we were like, actually.
Well, I will take it.
You just take it. Yeah.
Well, I got my money back for that journey at the weekend. So and I was quite fine. I mean, I did have to stand all the way home because, you know, if one train gets delayed, the next two, three are absolutely ram-a-lam-a-jam-dam.
Which journey at the weekend?
From York to London on the train.
All right, yeah.
I tell you what, though, I was left feeling quite smug about the fact that I made good use of my time. I had about an hour and 10 minutes, because I'm not that good at squeezing in productivity into a short amount of time, despite having two very good friends who are very, very good at that. That influence hasn't rubbed off on me as much as I'd like.
Yeah,
I was referring to you two, by the way.
Thank you. Very nice of you. Well, so you said it. So on the weekend, I was flying back from half term, and our flight got delayed and a bit more delayed. And I was just going through my emails from the week, and I was kind of like, well, I'll just keep doing this till we take off. And it just kept on being delayed. And I was like, just going through more and more. I was like, oh, I wasn't expecting to do four hours worth of emails here when we arrived at the airport, but. By the time we took off, and then I'd worked on the plane. By the time I landed, it's like, oh, brilliant! Well, that's done. And as you say, though, traveling with family, I must say, iPads and that kind of stuff have completely changed it. Because if when we were young, delayed for a plane, the kids have got nothing to do. They're running around a small airport causing chaos. Our kids were just so happy because they downloaded some things on Netflix and they were just happily sitting there watching that. It's like. Their best time ever.
Great.
I remember sleeping at a Greek airport as a kid and just doing like word searches and logic puzzles for hours and hours on the floor of a Greek airport. But you know, maybe I got quite good at word searches.
Yeah, it was the iPad of its day. Well, listen, there are no delays here. This podcast service continues its 100% reliability record. There was that one time I temporarily uploaded an episode with Jono's track muted. And that time I forgot to hit record. So, I don't know, let's call it an even 90% reliability record. That's still not bad. Right then, all aboard. Let's podcast. This week, we've picked Jono's helpful sketch that explores the meaning of the word bi-weekly and whether we should be using it at all. Because there's definitely room for ambiguity here, the consequences of which could be huge, or small, or somewhere in between. You should be able to see this sketch on your podcast player screens now, but if not, you can find a direct link to it in the episode description down below. You can also find our email address there to send us stories of your own experiences and thoughts about the topics we cover. To save you time now, though, Tom will tell you where to send your emails.
Hello@sketchplanations.com.
Thank you, Tom. And thank you for all your messages from the last week. We'll be going through a selection of those at the end of the podcast. Now, before we get going in earnest on this week's sketch, I have an important announcement to make. This week's sketch was chosen for a very good reason, in that it helps us explain that from the next episode, we'll be releasing this podcast bi-weekly. Now, to clarify that, I mean we'll be releasing them once every 2 weeks or fortnightly.
Dear, oh dear. I need to redo the sketch.
As a team, with all the stuff that we've got going on, we figured we'd be better placed to keep bringing you the quality of podcast you deserve by reducing the frequency of publication, for the short term at least. And when we talked about it, we listed at least 10 reasons why we think it's a better offering. And I won't bore you with that list now, but suffice to say, in our current situation, and for the time being, we'll be publishing new podcast episodes every 2 weeks. There. That's sorted. Okay, on to the sketch, Johnny. Why did you want to make this clarification? And was there something specific that happened to you that highlighted this discrepancy?
This sketch is, it's one of the things I like about actually doing Sketchplanations, because I feel like, I don't know, a lot of things feel like maybe there need to be big ideas for your career or make you look at something differently or whatever. Sometimes it can just be a little thing that actually you might find that you use on a regular basis in the future. And so it's like, here's something that I actually find quite useful. And I find myself telling people, whether they keep listening, I don't know. But
Sketchplanations, the podcast. We're here to help.
this came literally from writing and trying to explain in a very short space of time. So I've worked in web design for a long time. And so you're always trying to keep text as small and concise as possible, because basically people don't read text if it's on a website. But sometimes it's quite important. And so when I was at a company called Nutmeg and we were just starting out, it was an investment company, and you put, when people paid money in to be invested, we would do it bi-weekly. And it came back very clearly that people had different ideas of what our bi-weekly investing cycle meant. And people were quite annoyed if they'd waited a week and it hadn't happened, because we meant it was every 2 weeks instead of twice a week. And it turns out, if you go look up bi-weekly, it is actually in the definition that it can mean either of these two things. And the same is true of bi-monthly and biannually. I was actually on holiday one place and had a biannual festival, and it never specified whether that was twice a year or every 2 years. I'm still not sure to this day. So we were writing this thing, and then it was a chap we were working with called Ian Hollingshead, and he's a writer himself, and he said, why don't you use fortnightly? It's a really nice word. It gets rid of all the ambiguity of bi-weekly, and I use fortnightly every time since. He, by the way, has written some really nice books of their collections of people's letters to the Telegraph newspaper.
Okay.
And they've got cool titles like Imagine My Surprise.
Yeah. Nice.
Am I Alone in Thinking? Just as you might title these letters. They're quite fun. They're very funny books, actually. Anyway, so this tip is just... bi-weekly can actually mean twice a week or every 2 weeks. But if you just use fortnightly, there's no ambiguity.
Yeah. So I have an example also of when this didn't go as planned for me with vegetable delivery. Vegetable delivery to the house. So on the order form, there was a bi-weekly option. And what we wanted was a delivery once every 2 weeks, which probably makes sense. There's only two of us in the house. And I have to say, I admit, I did complete the form quite quickly without paying too much attention to the other options. But for that first week, we had a lot of vegetables to eat.
did it mean twice a week? That
it meant twice a week.
Yeah. So you got,
and
four,
I think if I paid more attention, we sorted it out after two. After two came within the same week, and we're expecting one, another 2 weeks, another one.
Did you send them the sketch? No, they need to know.
They need to know.
All these unhappy customers, terrible reviews.
I think if I'd paid a bit more attention, I would have seen the options either side of it, maybe put it in context.
So that's where I started. People don't pay attention.
You're right. I am people.
It's true.
Yeah.
I mean, so what we wanted, actually was something a bit more akin to bi-monthly. As in twice a month or roughly once every 2 weeks. But then there's a risk of getting delivery once every 2 months. Not enough veg. So, you know, same, not enough, too much. What we want is somewhere in between. We want the mummy bear porridge.
So technically bi-weekly and bi-monthly could mean the same.
Yeah. Two different people could mean the same thing and use those two.
One call it bi-weekly, one call it bi-monthly. You get the same amount of veg.
Do you see the problem, listeners?
Yeah. And then, hilariously, thinking the more you keep saying fortnightly, I know that my 12-year-old would be like, oh, is that the game? Does that mean I can play Fortnite? You know,
when he listens to this, his ears are going to pick up, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually, I searched actually, I'd not thought about it really for the etymology for it, and all I could find was references to the game Fortnite.
So if it said I want to order my vegetables fortnightly, it means I have to go out and kill 100 people
online
in order to
massive
get my
multiplayer competition.
Yeah, for anybody who doesn't know, Fortnite is a massive multiplayer online game. Where it's survival of the fittest, right? Survival of the winner. Yeah.
It's survival of the person who's played the most.
Yeah, probably.
It means 14 nights, by the way. Which just seems completely obvious now that I looked it up.
What, fortnightly?
Is like a contraction of 14 nightly.
Gotcha. Yeah.
There you go.
Oh, that's good.
A fortnight.
Oh yeah, I hadn't put two and two together with that.
So I was trying to think if you were like, if you want to say twice a year, you'd need like a Sixmas or something.
Yeah.
Every Sixmas. Yeah. For 6 months. I don't know.
Is Mass month?
It isn't. No. Mace's month in Spanish. It sort of sounds like it, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, okay, we'll go Sixmas.
Sixmas sounds very similar to Christmas twice a year.
A Sixmasly festival.
Sixmasly.
Yeah.
Tommy, have you had any examples of when you've come a cropper because of bi-weekly, bi-monthly, bi-annually?
Things that get very confusing in my world are calendar dates, because we deal with America and Asia quite regularly. So when it's kind of like 5th of the 3rd, it's like, oh, is that in a few days' time or is that May? And so I'm always very clear to make sure it's like 5th-March or 3-May, because that causes chaos dates.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is all in the same realm. This is ambiguity around time, right? How we're describing time.
Yeah, and information baffling.
Where this took me when I was thinking and enjoying researching around this was around the ambiguity of language that we have as a kind of wider context. And there's quite a bit. And I've discovered that there are basically two types of ambiguity in language. There's lexical ambiguity, which is the presence of two or more possible meanings within a single word, like with bi-weekly. And there's syntactic ambiguity, which is the presence of two or more meanings within a single sentence or a sequence of words. So, Tommy, so in the example of I saw her duck, did she duck or was she walking around with a duck? That's lexical ambiguity, as you say. And an example of syntactic ambiguity. This one's been pointed out in William Empson's book, The Seven Types of Ambiguity from 1947. And the phrase is, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed meeting your husband. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed meeting your husband.
Oh, yeah. Can't.
Two meanings? I can't tell you.
I'm struggling with that. What? Just because...
So you could take that as... the way we probably all took it. I can't tell you how much
like
I enjoyed
did.
Meeting you. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Well, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed meeting your husband.
Literally can't tell you.
Yeah, maybe yeah. I haven't met them. Or maybe, or I can't
tell
you.
Told me not to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Don't tell my wife how much you enjoyed meeting me.
There's in a slightly more fun one. A quote from Rowan Atkinson, and I presume is the introduction in a speech. Rowan is a famous comedian, British comedian. He's Mr. Bean, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
So he says, as I was leaving this morning, I said to myself, the last thing you must do is forget your speech. And sure enough, if I left the house this morning, the last thing I did was to forget my speech.
That's good.
So it is, and I guess ambiguity of language is a great source of wordplay and a great source of comedy as well, right?
When I sent out the fortnightly one, a couple of people wrote to me about some research that I really like. And I came across in the early 2000s by Lera Boroditsky. I think I might have mentioned it before, but it's such a classic example here, which is this ambiguity in time. And the classic example is if the meeting on Wednesday has been moved forward by 2 days, when is the meeting?
Oh, good. It's been moved forward. So there, I would say the meeting would be on Monday.
Yeah, interesting. And it's essentially, it's split. So some people will say the meeting has moved forward to Monday, and some people will think that it's now Friday.
Yeah, yeah, forward in time. Yeah,
exactly. And so it's ambiguous. And there's some really
good.
Fascinating like things about how we see time. So, for example, the typical Western way of talking about time is that time is like this long timeline that's spread out in front of us.
Yeah.
And so the future is ahead of us, as we would say, and the past is behind us.
Yes.
But that's not true for every culture. And there are some cultures where they say, well, you can see the past, but you can't see the future. So for them, the future's stretching out behind them, but the past is in front of them because that's what they can see. You can see.
Fair enough. It's logical. There's logic to that.
Yeah. And so it's just really fascinating ways that, like, actually, we don't all see these things the same way.
Wow. That I'm trying to get my head around that. That takes quite a bit of conscious effort to think about the past in front of you and the future behind you.
It makes total sense. Yeah,
I even had to think about saying that as I said it.
It's a kind of crazy one. And there was a great example also. She talks about there's an Aboriginal tribe who don't have words. They wouldn't use words for left and right. And so they do everything by like the cardinal directions, the compass directions, essentially. Yeah. So everything's north, south, east and west. And so whichever way you're facing, you always know which it is. And so she gives an example. You'd literally say, oh, look, there's an ant on your southwest leg.
Huh.
Or can you pass me the salt on your north, northeast?
But does that mean that you're constantly aware of where north, south, east and west is?
Yes.
From the sun, I suppose.
So they're always paying attention whichever way they're facing. And apparently the way you greet each other there is you say hello and you say which direction you're heading in.
Huh.
That is how you, that's kind of how you say hello. And for them, time doesn't stretch forward or backwards, it goes east-west.
Yeah.
So just really, like, yeah, like slightly mind-blowing things. You can't see Rob, but I've never seen his eyes quite so wide. Yeah. He's like, he's lost for words and his eyes are wide. Yeah, it's just, so yeah, I mean, you should check out, she does a really good TED talk about how language shapes how we think, which is really good. Tons of good stuff in it.
Yeah, well, I mean, just on that, when in terms of body language and what you give away when you're thinking or communicating, I'm riffing this a little bit. Isn't it that if we are recalling something from the past, then we'll look to our left, i.e. for us, kind of back on the timeline? Because that timeline you talked about in our Western culture, John, I think for me, that definitely is left to right as time progresses. So if you are recalling something, I think you tend to look to your left. Your eyes, your eyeballs do.
People have a direction that they will look. Yeah.
So, but I think this is sometimes used to determine whether somebody's lying or not.
Yeah.
But then if you're asked a question, to, I don't know, where were you last Thursday? Oh, I was here at home. Or where were you last Thursday? Oh, now I'm looking the other way.
I'm making it up.
For those taking this listening. In audibly, looking forwards, yeah, I'm making it up. I'm looking to some creative space.
Yeah.
And I think that, well, for me, that lines up with what you're talking about there, Jonna, with how we think about time and how we react within our conditioning of how we think and perceive time.
It's cool. I'm gonna ask people about questions about time and check which way they look now. I'm quite intrigued.
You liar!
You didn't have a coffee.
No, I was just looking that way because that's where the coffee is.
Good. Anyway, so that was, I just thought it was so fascinating because a couple of people sent me this about this ambiguity of time being forward or backwards. And
or left or right. Or right,
it's really cool. Or left or right, east and west. Yeah.
God, yeah. So when I was looking at the kind of comedic values or things that have unintentionally become quite funny within that syntactic ambiguity, i.e. sentences or phrases having different meanings, headlines, it appears, often have this ambiguity. And I'll give you some examples of headlines. Kids make nutritious snacks. Mother helps dog bite victim. And there's another one. Prostitutes appeal to the Pope.
That's very good. I've heard of those sort of things before. Did you come across what they're called?
I found them as part of unintended humorous examples of syntactic ambiguity.
So I learned that they're called, and I keep meaning to do a sketch of it, which is they're called garden path sentences.
Oh, no, I didn't see that at all. Oh, okay, brilliant.
You're leading someone one way with the sentence, and then it trips you up and it goes the other way.
Brilliant.
Because I found a couple which was like, because he always jogs a mile seems a short distance to him.
Because he always jogs a mile seems a short distance to him. Because he always jogs a mile.
I had another one which was, it was actually for a joke I saw a comedian do, which was, when he got older, my grandmother used to put butter on my granddad's back. After that, he went downhill very fast.
Yeah, brilliant.
But I just remember, like, that beginning bit, I thought it was pretty good. When he got older, my grandmother, and you're like, what? Yeah. He had a few others. He was the one who did the, do you know what's a nasty bee to get stung by? The hepatitis B. there were ones like missing lion remains found.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, quite confusing, like where you can interpret them both different ways. There was the old man, the boats.
The old man, the boats. Yeah.
So they're called garden path sentences where you're like, oh, yeah, you go one way and then it trips you and you go the other ways.
Which is a whole genre of comedy, right? It's like one line of comedy is all about that, taking your audience one way and then giving the old flipperoony at the end.
Yeah.
You know, it's a whole...
People would do it a lot better than I can.
No, it was good. I really enjoyed those. So what did I find? I found there's a study by Ricard Sol and Luis Sion of the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona. So excuse my pronunciation of those names. But it suggested that ambiguity is an essential part of how language works. In this paper, it suggested that if every single object and concept had a unique word for it, it would be very easy for the listener to understand what was going on without any confusion. But it's quite difficult for the speaker to construct that sentence because there'd be such this enormous vocabulary, right? But if on the flip side, if there are only a few words to describe everything, then speaking would be really simple, right? You know what you mean. You say the few words that you've got to do that. But understanding it would be very difficult and possibly fraught with danger, right? And so in this academic paper, it was deemed that in modern languages, we've got it just about right between too many and too few words, and that the ambiguity allows for creativity and individual interpretation of stuff, like with in poetry, or and as we've been talking about there, the garden path with comedy as well. I thought that was quite an interesting view on it. Again, we've not got too many, we've not got too few, we've got it mummy bear's porridge just right.
Yeah, that's really good. Where that doesn't necessarily apply was like legal language.
Yes.
And yeah, one of the sketches I've done was on the Oxford comma, which I think we might have touched on. Do you remember that?
No, we haven't touched on that, but I've learnt about it through the Sketchplanation, and I'm not entirely sure I fully understand it, but I use it. So carry on, Johnny. Let's explore that.
Yeah, so it's basically if you've got a set of items in a list, it's whether or not you have a comma after the second to last item in the list. And the classic example was like if you have a dedication on a book, which is to my parents, Lady Gaga and God.
Yes.
And without a comma, it's slightly ambiguous as to whether your parents are Lady Gaga and God.
Yeah.
Or is this a list of three things? Your parents, I'd like to dedicate this to my parents, to Lady Gaga and to God.
Yeah.
And there's that classic book you've seen, which is Eat, Shoots and Leaves.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, an example of the Oxford comma. But there was this fascinating legal case for a company in Maine. And in their contract, they had this line, like long line, saying the canning, processing, preserving, freezing, dry, and marketing, storing, packing for shipment or distribution of, and then carried on. And they ended up having to pay $5 million because there was ambiguity over whether packing for shipment was its own thing or whether it was packing for shipment or distribution, whether that was one thing by itself. Or whether they were two separate things, packing for shipment and distribution.
Yeah.
I think it applied to overtime pay. And so this ambiguity in a compliment, well, maybe you could interpret it this way. There was a super episode of Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History, which talked about the use of or absence of an Oxford comma in the American Constitution.
Oh.
And how it might determine like the formation of states and what you could do. It was basically like whether or not you can divide or add new states from within a state. And it's sort of ambiguous based on the placement of a comma or not as to whether or not you can. So it's just really fascinating how like even like you're right. And like, I think it's a good point. Actually, it's really helpful that language is ambiguous sometimes. Yeah. But sometimes you want to be really precise.
That's amazing with something like the American Constitution, which is handwritten, right, on big parchment paper, right, with quill pens. You know, a comma, that could just be a misplaced comma, could actually be just a little bit of ink or a fleck that's got on there and got ground
just
into the paper.
Sorry, yeah. don't worry about that.
It could be. Yeah. But the implications of it are absolutely massive.
Anyway, yeah, Oxford comes interesting.
Tommy, do you get involved in the legal stuff? I mean, because there must be loads of legal stuff that comes through you or requires sign-off from somebody. I won't read legal documentation most of the time because I just know that I can't understand it. But it kind of dawns on me that you might have to get stuck into it sometimes. Or have you got people who do that?
I do. And ultimately, I'm usually the one who has to do the final read and sign them. And you know, we are working with some of the world's biggest retailers who can have the most enormous legal documents that we then have to sign off on. And it, as you say, often you kind of read a sentence and you read it and you reread it and you're like, because quite often they have paragraph sentences with like no punctuation at all in this entire thing. And you're like, what does this mean?
It's funny, isn't it, when you get so precise that you sort of need a translation to understand it. Which I guess is true for many things. It's like, you know, in a scientific paper or a mathematic paper, like you have to be precise. But as a result, most people don't really bother to make the effort to learn it all. And the same is true with legal stuff, isn't it? You want to go, okay, well, what does Clause 13 really mean? Mm. What does it mean to me?
Yeah, within, but, well, so this is interesting. So there's another category of ambiguity in language that I didn't mention earlier, which is pragmatic ambiguity, which is kind of what we're talking about here, right? It's where the understanding of a word or phrase is based on the reality or the practicality of the context.
Yes.
Okay. Which I guess a lot of the time in legal terminology, a lot of it hopefully is defined more by the context of what's going on around it, but not always, you know, and probably could be held to account in a court of law for, you know, to be taken out of context. Like, as you say, with the canning factory, you know, within the context that you could probably argue it from a practical perspective, whichever it was, but then from a non-pragmatic perspective and looking purely at the words and the comma or lack of, it could be argued some different way. So context is obviously really, really important with the language that we use.
It's a really nice sketch. Basically, context is king. And it's just on this great example I saw in a research paper. And you might have seen it. It's quite difficult to explain in a podcast, but basically it has A, B, C and 12, 13, 14.
Oh, I remember
one on top
this.
Of each other. And if you look twice, the B is exactly the same as the 13, like literally exactly the same, like I copied them. But you read them ABC and you read them 12, 13, 14.
Brilliant.
And all of it is just context. You just like that's a 13 or that's a B, like without even missing a beat. And so we take context to everything that we're trying to interpret. But I guess you want to be careful if you're a lawyer.
Yeah. And I guess there's a difference here in between formal and informal communication, right? So, you know, it's very easy because we can see each other and we can hear each other in this conversation that hopefully our context is very well understood amongst all three of us, and hopefully by our listeners as well, who aren't necessarily seeing us, although you can watch extended versions of each episode up on YouTube. Because within language, in the way that we're communicating here now, we've got three major components to it, right? We've got our body language that we can see, we've got our tone of voice as well, including emphasis on different words, and there's the content of the words themselves. So together, hopefully, we can all understand what we're saying to each other very clearly. So an example of this kind of pragmatic ambiguity: the cops are coming. I tried to say that as flat as I could, right? That could be understood as a really good thing or a really bad thing, depending on what the situation was and your position within that whole scenario. The cops are coming, like leg it, or oh, phew, the cops are coming.
It's true.
But then with emphasis, Jono, going back to Mr. Schnell, is it Mr. Schnell?
Mr. Schnell.
Yeah, brilliant. In spoken language, emphasis brings a lot of meaning to a sentence. I never said she stole my money. Right. So many different meanings. I never said she stole my money. 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 Read. Has a different meaning.
Yeah, there's tons. I was thinking of context because I've got a sketch on capitanim. You say about like most of the times you have the context, and it's funny because kids often don't have the context.
Okay.
And at the very bottom of our road where I grew up, there's a little, it's a building, and on it says Polish Club. And for years I wondered what the Polish Club was, because it was in all caps. And it turns out it's an example of a capitanim, which is a word which changes meaning when it's a capital or
not.
Gotcha,
yeah.
And so, of course, it was a Polish club. But as a kid, I apparently didn't have that context and was just baffled for quite a long time. And obviously there's some really obvious ones like Turkey, where normally, because of the context, you assume, pass me the turkey. You don't assume people are talking about the country. Or China, right? You know, there's another one like that. Lent. Tom, did you say, are we in Lent now?
Yeah,
but you know when you talk about Lent that you're either talking about Lent or you lent somebody something, you know.
So I was going to flip it slightly, and instead of talking about the ambiguity of language, I was going to talk about, I don't know if you've heard this before, but the Inuit language famously has many words for different types of snow, right?
Yeah.
Interestingly, Hawaiian language doesn't distinguish between snow and ice. I mean, they probably don't really have to deal with that, the nuances of that cold weather too often. But do you know which language supposedly has the most words for types of snow?
No.
Russian. In at five, it's Swedish with 25. In at four, it's Icelandic with 46. The Inuit language has somewhere between 40 and 70 words for snow. The Sami language, northern Scandinavia or Russia, Tommy,
the Kaffikoks, weren't they?
They were the Kaffikoks, exactly. They've got around 180 words for snow. But in at one, Scottish.
Huh.
421 words, apparently, they have for different types of snow, including gems such as feeful, which is swirling snow, flindrikin, a brief snow shower, and spitters, small flakes of wind-driven snow. Feeful, flindrikin, and spitters.
I'd like to come back in and say, how is it outside? Oh, it's flindrikin. Out there, and they'd know exactly what I meant.
Well, they would if they were Scottish. If they were, they wouldn't understand what you're talking about anyway, half the time, probably. Or you wouldn't understand what they were saying, rather.
This is possible.
I mean, I've got it's snowing.
It's snowing. Snow,
it's quite wet snow.
Wet snow, dry snow, champagne snow.
Big flakes. Big snowflakes. Big chunky snow.
Hard,
I think,
snow.
I'm scraping the barrel now. Yeah, hard snow. Yeah.
Neve.
Yeah.
That's a type of snow, isn't it? That's when snow compacts before it becomes ice. I think that's the process of when a glacier forms. It's snow on snow on snow, and then it neve, and then it's ice underneath it, I think. Remember that from geography?
Oh, nice. So I'm imagining the Hawaiians don't have a word for that either.
No.
For neve.
No. But they've probably got a lot of words for sand. Or surf. They've probably got a lot of words for waves in Hawaii, I imagine.
I bet they do. Whereas, again, I've got big and small. That's it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? You don't have to go to different languages, just in different cultures, right?
Yeah.
not even cultures, just groups of people,
dialects.
Like, of course, if you're surfing waves, you can't just call it a wave.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a really good wave out there today. Like, there might be a type of wave, but there might be some distinction to it. I was just reading a book with an 11-year-old, and it was Lego, and it had all sorts of different ways you might describe your Lego builds, which if you're spending all your days building Lego, you might come up with all these different ways of describing it.
Well, you know, if you're really into your music, you know, people will, music journalists and real musos, you know, they'll have loads of words that they can use, that they have at their fingertips to be able to describe music. Whereas somebody who's not necessarily that interested in music might enjoy music but not necessarily that interested in it. You know, it's loud, it's
quiet.
Got a good beat. I'm thinking of a mutual friend,
are you?
We digress. Is there anything anybody else would like to add on the subject of, let's call it, linguistic ambiguity, or around bi-monthly and fortnightly?
Can I put one little plug for a poem? A link to it from the sketch I have about homonyms and homographs and homophones and heteronyms, all these different types. And somebody, when I posted that, somebody sent me this poem called The Chaos by Gerard Nolst Trenite. And it's an 800-word poem, and it basically highlights all of the ridiculous pronunciations in English.
Okay.
So I try and just give you one verse, which is like, I will keep you, Susie, busy, make your head with heat grow dizzy, tear in eye, your dress you'll tear, queer fair seer, hear my prayer. And so all of these ones where you've got like Susie and busy, it's USY and a letter. But one of them you pronounce Susie and one of them you pronounce Boozy.
Busy.
No, Busy.
Busy.
tear in eye and your tear address. But it's T-E-A-R. And head and heat is H-E-A. But one is hair and one is he.
Yeah.
And so like the whole poem is like just the craziness of English and all the different ways that you can say these words. And you look at a word and you're like, what, horse and worse? You know, like, how are you supposed to know how to pronounce any of this stuff? Mm. You just have to learn everything. So it's amazing. So if you look up the chaos as a poem, you'll find it.
At school, I was very fortunate in that I had extra English for my dyslexia. What we would do effectively is we'd go through the different sounds that each of the letters can make. So A, for example, there are at least 7 different ways that A can be sounds, can be said, like talk, bay. Bay and hay, obviously, but talk and ant, and you know, there's all these different ways that an A can sound, and that's just the first letter of the alphabet. The vowels have a huge number, but as you say, hippo and hello, and you know, it's just flipping confusing, and you just have to just learn them, and often eventually they just sound right.
All right, so to summarise then, within the specifics of this week's sketch, are we saying that for absolute clarity, we should avoid using words like bi-weekly, bi-monthly or bi-annually? And that if you'd like something to be done every 2 weeks, you should say fortnightly or spell it out once every 2 weeks. Or if it's twice a year, you should say that, exactly that. Is that what we're saying?
Bye-bye to bi-weekly.
Yeah, or every second month, 2 times each year. Somebody said you could maybe use semi-weekly.
What does that mean?
Is that twice a week?
Well, yeah. It doesn't sound like two, does it?
No. Semi, half. Yeah, half weekly. Yeah, it's just...
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Let's ban these words.
Yeah.
I mean, from my perspective, I'd like to make it quite clear that I'm quite a big fan of these opportunities for ambiguity sparked into our language. I think it makes it a bit more fun, doesn't it? As we've talked about.
When you get too many vegetables.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you could just say, when would you like your vegetables? Later. We'll bring your vegetables later.
No, later than that. Yeah. It was a good week for soup.
Made lemonade.
Yeah, exactly.
Made soup.
Thanks for rounding that off, Jono. I appreciate that. Thank you very much, chaps. Another very fun topic on language. If you've enjoyed this conversation, you might enjoy episode 14 from series 1, which was a bumper pack episode on all sorts of stuff to do with words and language. And Jono's done loads of sketches on this kind of thing, as we've talked about in this episode. I'll put links to all of those sketches that we referenced in the podcast episode description down below. And there'll undoubtedly be more episodes like this in the future. We'd love to know what you think of language ambiguity. And if you've ever fallen foul of it, send us your emails to hello@sketchplanations.com. Or you can leave us messages on social media. But before we round off this episode, I'd just like to reiterate once again that the next fresh podcast to drop in your feed after this one will be in 2 weeks' time. So as mentioned at the top of the pod, we're going fortnightly so we can continue to guarantee the quality for the pod. Hashtag podqual. So one last time for absolute clarity, this podcast is now going bi-weekly. We'll see you then. Thanks very much for listening. Go well, stay well. Goodbye. Right, we're back. Let's have a quick look in this week's post bag. What have we got, chaps? So last week we were talking about sneaky averages. What are people saying about sneaky averages? John, I think you've got one.
Yeah, there was a couple of comments on it that I saw. One of them was a suggestion, looking forward to the sketchplanation of kernel density and kurtosis after that one. So we're really getting deep into the statistics. Another one.
Kernel density and kurtosis.
Kurtosis. Halitosis. I don't know what they are. Right? I don't know.
Are they like statistical tools, maybe? Well, or...
I don't know what they are.
Yeah.
If Jono doesn't know what they are, serious maths.
I have heard of kurtosis. I've not heard of the other one.
Okay, good. Yeah. Yep. Crack on. I'll look that up. That's that. Yeah. I can look that up for maths.
I mean, I think it might be getting a bit niche to go real into the mathematics ones.
Fair enough. Good.
Had another one from a CFO who said, carry this mental image around with you. And that's the mental image of the statistician drowning in the 3 feet average pool. Yes. With you next time when someone presents an average to you. It's true more often than not, I found. So it's clearly someone with experience of averages saying that a lot of averages are hiding something.
More often than not, in their experience, they say. Yeah.
Yeah, I just think if you get an average, you just don't know. And you rarely, in like a newspaper or something, get enough information to really assess it and know what's going on.
Have you guys ever used an average in a speech or something, or in a public a presentation, where you know that there's the potential for it to be sneaky and that it could be hiding something? Not that you are trying to hide something, but you just think, for this audience, it's fine. Let's crack on. I'll use this average without having to explain it.
It's really true. Yeah, because you're like, well, it takes a really long time to tell all the details. So a real common thing would be, you know, visitors to the Sketchplanations website, and you look at like bounce rate, and which is like how many people turned up, looked at the things for a few seconds and left. And so the average the average visit to a website might be 40 seconds. Maybe that was enough to read what was there. But actually the average visit might be even 10 seconds or something like that. But that might completely hide the few people who spent an hour on there, you know, reading things for an hour and visited 80 pages. But the question is, in what you're going to present, do you have time to go into that level of detail? Yeah. Do you have time, and do you actually have the data to go like break it all down and go, okay, well, there's no point in me saying the average time, because there isn't an average. There's people who turn up and go, oh, this is the wrong place, and there's people who turn up and spend an hour reading because they love it. So you have to decide, do you have time and do you have the data to say it all? So I definitely done that when you're talking about website analytics and things like that.
Rob, are you asking if I've ever portrayed data in a presentation to, say, a lord who might be a business owner in a way to highlight what I wanted to say rather than potentially what he was thinking? I certainly never.
I wouldn't dare suggest that,
good,
Tommy.
Good, just checking.
Despite all the tips that we were talking about, all three of us last week, about how you can make graphs look more impressive for your sales. Not your sales generally.
Yeah. Was it data is like a human being? The more you torture it, the more it'll say what you want it to say.
There you go. Tommy, did you have a message? I don't think it's from Sneaky Averages. It was from
from someone who apologised, isn't that kind, saying they've been super busy, so they're a little bit behind on their listening.
That's all right. Welcome.
It's very good. But also, he'll be glad to hear that it's now it's fortnightly going forward, not biweekly, Robert. Fortnightly. But he was very impressed that I knew that it was four cylinders in his car when I yelled it out when we were in the back of Knowlesy's XC90. I was also quite relieved to see that I'd got it right. I've just Googled it to just check that I had the right answer. And he was a bit surprised that the owner of the car didn't know how many cylinders. I wonder how many people do.
Well, if you remember, Knowlesy didn't know what a piston cylinder was. So knowing how many the engine in his car had, it would really surprise me if he knew that.
Yeah, the big question is, how many pistons are there in an electric car?
Yeah. You'd probably have a piston inside your suspension system, wouldn't you? Inside your dampener. A piston of sort, a piston inside a cylinder. It's not doing the same thing. Okay. It's not connected to a crank, as Jez pointed out in previous comments. But yeah, I think you'd have a piston inside a cylinder for a hydraulic dampener on your suspension, wouldn't you? Yes.
Oh, you're right.
Let us know. three engineers signing off for another week. Thank you for all your comments. Keep them coming in, and we'll try and I've got homework now from this week's listener comments. Thanks for that, guys. But always a pleasure. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Hi.
All music on this podcast series is sourced from the very talented Frank Cinelli. And you can find loads more tracks at frankcinelli.com.